I'll call to order the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. And to start with, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. And committee, this may look very familiar with you. It's exact same wording as in House Bill 2007, which we heard last week. And Janet, can you help explain to us again what the bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill would authorize the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish pilot projects for the consolidation of state licenses and allow state agencies that participate in the pilot to use combined applications, adopt common license terms, to charge adjusted fees, and to issue combined licenses. DCBS is directed to prepare a proposal for combined licensing of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, the Office of Regulatory Streamlining has been working with retailers and several state agencies on a small retailer consolidated renewal project, and the intent is to reduce the number of licenses that small retailers, and I believe the example was a convenience store, has to go through with the state. Patrick Allen is here from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. You also have at your place a fiscal impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And it was zero?
Mr. Chair, it's a bit indeterminate. It says that the bottom line for this reason, LFO also assumes that agencies would absorb any cost they experience in a pilot project. So.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. There's no one signed up this morning. Patrick, do you have any more comments? Huh? And he's shaking his head no. So. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2005 and open a work session on House Bill 2005. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I have been passed Bill 2005 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2005 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Esposito. Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitt.
Aye.
Representative
Chalker.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carried. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that make a motion that House Bill 205 be put on the consent calendar on the floor.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2005 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2527. And Janet, was there anyone signed up?
No, Mr. Chair, this is a
work session.
Okay. Can you give us a rundown on what the bill does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2527 was heard at the end of the day when you heard a number of bills related to the manufactured housing and structures program. This bill would transfer the regulation of manufactured structures from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to a newly established Manufactured Structures and Parks Board. The new board would have regulatory authority over manufactured housing construction, installation, dealership, registration of ownership, and manufactured dwelling parks. The board membership would be 12 members appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. It would remove the regulation of recreational vehicles as manufactured structures. Mr. Chair, it does appropriate money and dedicate fees to the board for operation of the program, and it would become operative January 1st, 2008. Mr. Chair, this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And Don Miner is here, and Mark Long is here from the Building Code Division. If there's any questions.
Does anyone have any further questions? Don, did you have anything additional you wanted to add to testimony?
John Brenneman's here.
Yeah, and John, did you have anything? Any problem with this? And you got your hand full of coffee there, I see.
morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Your committee administrator described very correctly what the bill does, but it does need a lot more work. Our hope is that you'll refer it to the Ways and Means Committee, where there can be a work group established to sort through the issues, the budgetary issues and the policy issues. It looks like a good way to line up, put all the manufactured home programs in one spot. I know that the park folks aren't necessarily sure that they want to be part of this.
Thank you, Don.
Mr. Chair, John Brenneman, I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and our position at this point is that we don't think we want to make that move with the parks. And Don and I have talked about this for several months back and forth, and I think he's going to get an opportunity to make a pitch up to our legislative committee and see if the minds can be changed. But at this point, if it's moved to Ways and Means, I'm comfortable with that. I work well with Don. And if we remove that out of a work group, we can do so at that time.
Thank you, John. Any question? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Appreciate it. Mark, did you have some?
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes. Our organization as well is comfortable with if the committee chooses to move this to Ways and Means and work on a work group. The bill as written would need some modifications in order for us to be comfortable with the bill. Just to kind of give you a quick snapshot, you know, our primary responsibility is to adopt codes, construction standards, and to make sure that we achieve consistency between state regulations and local regulations. There are pieces of the manufactured housing industry that could be set aside that would not impact those other connecting codes or coordinating codes that I'm responsible for. So if through a work group, if a proponent was willing to look at some of the issues we've discussed with them, we'd be happy to participate in that process. So
thank you, Mark.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mark? Don't see any. Thank you very much for testifying this morning. Committee, Representative Hitz.
Mr. Chair, are you ready to entertain a motion?
Yes, I would.
I would move House Bill 2527 to Ways and Means with no recommendation at this point in time until the groups can get together.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2527 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Crawford.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Vestal.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Motion carries. Let's see. Could we ask and get them? The chair would entertain a motion to have the rules waived to allow Representative Schaffler to vote on House Bill 2005. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the rules be suspended, allowing Representative Schaffler to vote on House Bill 2005.
Representative Kitts moves the rules be suspended to allow Representative Schaffler to vote on House Bill 2005. Is there any objection? Seeing none, how do you vote, Representative?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler votes aye on House Bill 2005. The bill is represented, and it is the bill will be placed on the consent calendar.
Oh, very good.
Any objection? No. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2117. Janet, can you tell us what this bill does again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2117 was the bill that is the bill that dealt with private investigators, and you had a hearing on January 31st. Representative Schaffler worked with some of the interest groups and especially the administrator and board member from the Board of Investigators on amendments to the bill. The bill created quite a stir because of some of the exemptions that were being taken away in the bill. Just briefly, the House Bill 2117, the original bill creates a temporary investigator's license for investigators that are licensed in other states to practice in Oregon for a limited time. It creates an interim license for applicants who meet specified conditions to work as investigators during their application process. The original bill reduced and made the exceptions to the license more general, and the Dash 3 amendments take away any changes to the exemptions for the license. So all the current exemptions are maintained in the amendments.
Mr. Chair, are there just Dash 1s and Dash 3s, or am I missing?
That's all I have. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Are the Dash 1s within the Dash 3s?
I believe they are, yes.
So we only have to adopt Dash 3?
No. Mm-hmm. Representative Schaffer, are you satisfied with what we've come out here with?
Well, there's nobody to say any different, and I think I am.
Okay. Is there anyone here that would like to testify on House Bill 2117? I don't see anyone.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to get on the record that the genealogists have been taken out of this.
They were never in it.
They were never in it, and they ain't going to be in it, and they'll forever make it so.
And this was a genealogist?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. To entertain a motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, let Derek get
it. Representative Kitt.
Time out.
Okay.
I'm just trying to verify. Janet, are you for sure, for certain that the Dash 1s have been moved into the Dash 3s? I was just trying to find it really quickly. And
okay, Mr. Chair. I'll have to...
I want to just make sure before we move.
Verify that myself.
On page 3.
Mr. Chair, because the Dash 1s brought legal process servers back in as an exemption, and the Dash 3 amendments delete that whole section, process servers would maintain their exemption. So it's not, you don't see the language in the
Dash. The Dash 1 have not been moved into the Dash 3s, but we're not moving the Dash 1s.
Right.
So the Dash 3s, what they do is they, the bill contained, took away or put back in some exemptions that were in the existing statutes. The Dash 1s put one of those back. The Dash 3 just removes that whole section of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to say that I voted for the $87 billion before I voted against it. So with that, I'm fine with these amendments.
Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal statement on the original bill that is not changed by the amendments, and it has to do with the different fees for the temporary licenses and things like that.
Okay. The chair would entertain a motion to do something. Okay. Representative Schaffer.
I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2117.
Representative Schaffer moves the Dash 1s to 2117.
Dash 3s. That's what I said, Dash 3s.
Yes, and that's what we both said, Dash 3s.
What I meant to say was.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 3s are adopted. Representative Schaffer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2117. This is not a referral, does it? To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Representative Schaffer moves House Bill 2117 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just that there must be some weapons of mass destruction in here somewhere.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Seeing none. Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Colby.
It's on now.
Representative Kitt. Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Schaffer, would you like to carry this bill and try to explain it on the floor? Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Representative Schaffer will carry the bill on the floor for us. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
At the hearing.
as a recommendation to Representative Schaffler, it might be easier for him to carry this bill if he first takes it out of his lock box.
Trying to get all those into there.
My do you remember the My father used to sing
it. Doesn't do anything.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3324. And ask that Tim Martinez or Janet first give us a rundown on what you think the bill does.
Yes, that's a good what I think it does. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3324 would allow an Oregon bank or trust company to organize as a limited liability company as an alternative to being organized as a corporation. There are terms defined in the bill, and the bill specifies that organization as an LLC will be under the authority of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It requires the LLC to be managed in substantially the same manner as an Oregon bank or trust company organized as a corporation is currently managed, with the same rights and responsibilities. It specifies that membership, and when you see member, it really means owner, interests are freely transferable. It allows, under specified steps, conversion of an existing bank or trust company that's organized as a corporation to an LLC, and it also has the alternative conversion of an LLC. If it's formed as an LLC, it can be converted to a corporation under a similar sort of steps. The steps include approval by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill also specifies how stockholders and owners may dissent from plans for conversion and receive the value of their shares. Mr. Chair, limited liability companies have the liability protection that's similar to a corporation and may be qualified for tax advantages. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Tim Martinez, Ken Sherman, and Fred Postlewhite, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Martinez, here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association in support of the Bankers Association bill, House Bill 3324. To my immediate right is Fred Postlewhite, who will have some comments in a couple of minutes. Mr. Postlewhite is the president and CEO of Oregon Coast Bank with the headquarters in Newport, Oregon. Mr. Postlewhite is also a member of the Oregon Bankers Association Board of Directors. To his right is a gentleman familiar to this committee, Ken Sherman, Jr., OBA counsel. Ken will also be able to go through kind of the steps that this bill contemplates in allowing banks and trust companies to set up as limited liability companies. Before I turn it over to Mr. Postlewhite, let me just say briefly that when Oregon allowed corporations to form as LLCs in the early 90s, banks were not included in that legislation. The reason they were not included in that legislation was at that time there was no way for them to get FDIC deposit insurance, so it really made no sense to do that. In 2003, the FDIC promulgated some rules that said, yes, it is okay, we will insure banks that are organized as LLCs. In a nutshell, an LLC gives a group that's trying to form a bank a little more flexibility than a sub-S, which banks are allowed to form as. Sub-S right now, or up until last year, you could only have 75 shareholders. Congress has increased that to 100, and there is a bill working through your legislature that would also amend Oregon law to change it to 100. So when you look at sub-S and LLC, the LLC is just a little more flexible. Your administrator did raise the question of tax advantages. I'm not very good at numbers, but let me just say this. This does, an LLC does allow benefits of corporate tax advantage. What you give up for that, though, is you all the income flows down to the shareholders, and rather than paying a 6% corporate tax, they pay a 9% tax. So I'm not very good at math, but I think it's a fairly good deal for the state as well. Having said that, I would turn it over to Mr. Postlewhite.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Chairman Brown. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Fred Postlewaite, President and CEO of Oregon Coast Bank, with offices in Newport and Pacific City. Our bank is 2 years, 9 months old, and opened in July 8, 2002. Our Pacific City office is 1 year old. We're a community bank chartered and regulated by the state of Oregon and insured by the FDIC. Our lending area includes Lincoln and Tillamook counties. We're truly a small community bank. Our loan portfolio consists of items from that area. Among those borrowing needs are loans to fishermen for boats, gear, and processing, farmers for dairy cows, feed, land purchases. We've financed aquaculture projects such as oyster farms, and made loans to loggers for operating capital equipment and the purchase of small woodlots. We loan to hotels, bed and breakfasts, and restaurants. And in addition, we make the usual loans for the construction and purchase of homes, autos, and other consumer needs. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we urge your adoption of HB 3324, permitting a bank to organize or convert to a limited liability company. It will increase competition, provide additional dividends to our shareholders, and most importantly, give community banks a 21st century organizational model better suited to help them continue in the future to provide fundamental financial services to Oregon's small communities and businesses. I'm especially aware of this survival issue because I have recent experience dealing with it. I was president and CEO of Lincoln Security Bank in Newport from its organization in 1996 to its sale to a larger bank in 2001. The sales offer was unsolicited, but the $25 per share price for stock originally offered to $10 was financially very fair to our shareholders. At 5 years of age, we were still considered a new bank and had not as yet paid any dividends to our shareholders. Had we been either a subchapter S corporation or a limited liability company and been paying dividends to our shareholders, we may have been able to keep local control of that bank. The bank shareholders were treated fairly, but many of the other stakeholders in the community bank, its borrowers, employees, local merchants selling goods and services to the bank and community groups, lost something in the sale. However, we were fortunate in several respects. We still had an experienced community bank staff, a committed group of individuals willing to be bank directors, and I should interrupt right here, three of those founding bank directors, which is kind of a thankless task, are with me today. One, Frank Bronner, retired OBA executive director, all of you have probably seen in one form or another over the years. If they would stand to. Dr. Richard Beamer was our original chairman. He's a retired surgeon from the Newport area. And Dwayne Edwards is our current chairman and is a fisherman in the area. Having these people was a big advantage, but the most important advantage we have is that we had a vibrant and dynamic community with a long tradition of locally owned and operated banks. Two of the banks, one was organized in 1925 and the other was organized in 1935. They had changed ownership only, both of them had changed ownership by the early 90s. But people were used to dealing with community banks. Technically, Lincoln County is a disadvantaged county, one of six in Oregon's 36 counties eligible for guaranteed loans from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Still, we raised the $4.75 million needed for capital, and that was almost $2 million more than we had to raise in 1996, which is one of the hurdles to getting into banking. We raised it in less than 60 days. We had 140 investor shareholders, and more often than not, they had one question. It was a question, especially when there's so many banks changing names, but the question is, how can we be assured that the new Oregon Coast Bank will be there for the community in the years to come? Well, there is a way, and it involves modernizing the corporate structures for state-chartered banks. As Tim mentioned earlier, we were kind of left out in the 2001 because of the coordination between what the state was looking to do and what the FDIC dictated that insured banks could do. We had very few options to offer our shareholders, and the economic pendulum was swinging very definitely in the direction of continued buying and consolidation of small community banks. There was, however, one option that was developing during that time, and that was subchapter S banks. The very smallest family-owned banks, mostly in the Midwest, bought this option almost wholesale. And they began converting from the older traditional C corporation structure. Subchapter S banks didn't fit too many banks because of its limitation to 75 shareholders and a requirement that none of the stock be purchased with IRA funds. In October, just this past October, thanks in part to our Senator Smith and Representative Walden, new Subchapter S legislation was introduced and passed through Congress, raising the number of shareholders from 75 to 100 and allowing IRA purchase stock. At present, there are 3,000 Subchapter S banks across the country, and two of them are here in Oregon. There is a second option, and that's the HB 3324 before you today. Now, Tim mentioned how this got started, and in my testimony, I have a couple of paragraphs explaining this. We don't need to wander through that again, but it is an option that the FDIC is now allowing, kind of as, I think, just an acknowledgement of the facts of life in this day and age, that LLCs are a primary business structure. Additionally, we believe the Comptroller of the Currency, regulators to the national banks, will be doing something on this matter, that they'll look into it and seek authority to permit limited liability companies as national banks. Were that to happen, one option would be that Oregon banks could convert their state charters to a national charter. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for a whole host of reasons, we prefer to remain a state chartered bank and would hope that the LLC option would be an Oregon option. Very frankly, neither of the newly amended Subchapter S legislation nor the proposed LLC legislation in HB 3324 is a perfect fit for Oregon Coast Bank. We're reforming the bank today. We would do so designed specifically to conform in all respects to one or the other structures. That being said, it is the plan of the Board of Directors of Oregon Coast Bank to review both options, if available, and submit a proposal for conversion to our shareholders later this year. We believe that new banks in the coming years will look at the sub-S and LLC options as well as the older and traditional C corporation format. Ultimately, they will choose the one they believe best fits their bank and the communities that they serve. That they should have this option, these options, is right and just and could be the event that causes the consolidation pendulum to reach its zenith and begin its swing the other way. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to appear here today. If I can respond to any questions, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you. Why don't we take Ken's testimony and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I think Tim and Fred have done an excellent job of giving you an overview of this bill and its genesis. We see this as a piece of legislation that helps bring the Oregon Bank Act into the 21st century. We've been living here in Oregon with LLCs as a form of doing business since 1993. We went through an extensive process of rewriting the Oregon Bank Act in 1997, but unfortunately at that time, LLCs were still the new kid on the block. They were really, their dimensions were not very well understood or known, and so we didn't even really consider at that time, and I participated extensively in that Bank Act revision process, but we really didn't consider changing the Bank Act at that time to allow this alternative of forming banks as LLCs. But time has passed, and other states have been moving in this direction. I think Texas was the first state in our country to allow LLCs to be, or banks to be organized as LLCs. There are now several other states. I know Colorado is one, and I'm told that there are about 20 states now that are either have a similar bill on their books or are considering similar legislation this session. Tim and Fred have told you about the change in the FDIC rules, which has been an extremely important part of this process. We really couldn't have gotten anywhere in this concept without that cooperation from the FDIC. And there's still more work to be done at the federal level. The IRS will need to issue changes to its own regulations, and I understand that there's a hearing pending on that in the next week or so. So that part of the process is moving forward. It's in my practice, I spend maybe 30 or 40% of my time working for the OBA and the other rest of my time is in doing a variety of things that civil lawyers do, and I do a lot of work in organizing new businesses. And it's pretty rare for me in my practice today to organize any other form of business as anything other than an LLC. There's still an occasional client who will want to be organized as a corporation, either a general corporation or a subchapter S, but it seems like the LLCs have really overtaken the world, and I think it's now time, having waited for the last 11 years, to move the Bank Act forward in this direction. And so that's what this bill is about. I've prepared testimony, and I think that's been distributed to you, and you will find that that testimony includes a section-by-section analysis of the bill. I would be happy to go through that, but in deference to your time and busy schedule, I would just leave that for your own reading, and I think all of us would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Banks now could be chartered under the federal banks, or could be chartered as LLCs?
No. Mr. Chairman, that would take a change by the comptroller, and that's what Mr. Postlewaite was talking about, the pending or the concept apparently now with the comptroller of the currency, which is the regulator for the national banks, to consider allowing them to be organized as LLCs as well. Currently, they are required to be organized as corporations, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Starting on Representative Shields.
Okay. Can I ask a couple of questions, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Thanks. Tim, talking about the tax ramifications of this, I'm a social worker by trade, not a tax lawyer, so maybe you can help me with this. Currently, Oregon banks pay 6% corporate tax. Is that what you were suggesting? And then the shareholders would also pay tax on that income. Is that how the current statute works?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, the way it works now in the corporate structure is, yes, banks can pay as much as 6% on corporate tax. The shareholders pay only on their dividends.
Mm-hmm.
This would eliminate the 6% tax, but would substitute a 9% individual tax. So as the profits flowed through down to the individual shareholders, like any other limited liability company.
Okay, so the structure then is similar to subchapter S corporations then in the tax advantages. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, that is.
Except you could have more than 100 or 75 members. Correct. So is it fair to say that because you're going from essentially double taxation is single, that this might end up affecting decreasing the amount of revenue that the state of Oregon brings in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, that certainly may be a possibility, but it's certainly not our expectation.
Okay.
And Fred wants to add to that as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, at Lincoln Security, we were in existence 5 years, and we've been in existence 3 years, and we have as yet to pay a dividend. So in those two instances, nothing went through to the shareholders. So this would be a net gain for especially a new young bank trying to get into profitability and getting started. But the overall 9%, and you're only paying on the dividends themselves, the 9% on the dividends. So my anticipation is that the state wouldn't suffer anything. If any, little, if anything at all.
I have an LLC that handles some property through, and the profits that are earned within that LLC are paid with that year. I have to pay it regardless whether it's passed through to the members, and as opposed to in a C corporation, the profits are taxed that year within the bank or within any C corporation, as I understand it, and only taxed when they're passed through to the stockholder in the form of dividends. The difference being the LLC, regardless if they make profit that year, they pay the 9% on it, regardless whether the member receives that actually in cash or not. He's still obligated for that tax. Is that right? Right. Representative Schaffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the zenith of consolidation. And I'm afraid to even say this, but I pray to God Walmart doesn't get into the banking industry. Will this help smaller local banks remain and
be competitive in the banking market. Will this bill help that?
Chairman Brown, Representative Schaffler, yes, it will. And that's when we were looking at this 5 years, all of our shareholders in the last bank were thrilled at the return. But those who had who looked a little more to that, looked to the community, really didn't want to sell. I mean, the profits were nice, but they wanted the bank to exist and be around for a little longer. And our directors, this gentleman with me today, from the very beginning, we looked at the advantages of a sub-S and LLC as kind of the legislation at the end of the rainbow, which may ensure that we can stick around longer. I was talking to some of my banker friends and seeing how few young people they were hiring, and I'm in the community bank circles, I'm not in the very largest, but they are hiring relatively few young people because they see their existence timeline as approximately 5 years. Like somebody will come in and make us an offer to buy the bank, and there's little we can do to stop it. Mm-hmm. So they don't cause anything to happen, and it takes a lot of training to become a banker. You've got to go through economic cycles and do that. So you see most of them, at our bank, we were looking at this, and we were pretty much run by and staffed by a bunch of 50-year-old people, and that's not good for the future. But by opening up the sub-S and LLC-type provisions to this and having a way where the investors can get some type of return, even if they're taxed, pay a healthy tax on it, but they get something in their hands every year, will ensure that these banks have a chance of continuing into the future. And in our little community of Newport, where we are resource-based in fishing and logging and tourism-based, those are very small, relatively speaking, industries that need this type of business. In 2 years and 9 months, we've made almost exactly $100 million worth of loans into our community. I had the folks add it up the other day here, and I was kind of surprised by that. And for a little tiny bank, it kind of surprised me. I guess, relatively speaking, in terms of billions, it's not a lot. But when you put $100 million into a community of 10,000 and a community up in Pacific City of less than 1,000, it's a big impact.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm as concerned as anybody, especially Representative Shields, about the loss of revenue in the state of Oregon. But that being said, I think that scenario you just talked about, isn't quantified, isn't pointed out in the bottom line in our revenue projections and what we see. But eventually it does get there in a roundabout way. In my opinion, it will help these smaller communities continue to thrive and keep the money there rather than having it sent off to some high-rise in Portland or Chicago or New York. That's what I'm hoping this helps do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if they're behind me today, but DCBS has looked at this draft. FDIC has looked at this draft. DCBS, as my understanding, is neutral on the bill, and we've also made the amendments that FDIC wanted. So as far as I'm aware, none of the regulators have an issue with this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to also echo just my concern about revenue impact to the state, and would hope that legislative revenue would weigh in on this. It's hard for me to believe that there would be no revenue impact. But in light of that, I'm just kind of curious about the timing of this and why the state should move this direction when, in fact, we may have some possible issues with the IRS code, and are we, you know, for tax purposes, disconnecting from the IRS tax code in the way we treat LLCs and giving them this partnership status when the IRS has yet to do that. It would seem like we would wait for the IRS to move on that before we move forward. But I may be wrong. Maybe you have a reason for doing it this way. If you could elaborate on that a little bit for me, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, I want to be sure that we're all on the same page here. LLCs now are a pass-through entity, and the IRS recognizes them as such. So we have thousands of businesses in Oregon that are organized as LLCs. All this bill will do is allow the banks to join, or those that choose this course, to join that large group of others. So the only piece of the IRS regulations that need to fall in place before we can actually have banks either organizing to or converting to, or organizing as or converting to LLCs, is that part which is really based on the FDIC's old position. The IRS regulations have not caught up to that old position with regard to the corporate entity and the requirement in the FDIC Act that a bank be organized as a corporation. Did I clarify or muddy?
Well, in your testimony, you say that follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow me.
In your testimony, you say that the Internal Revenue Service needs to adopt changes to its regulations recognizing bank and trust company LLCs as eligible for partnership treatment under the IRS code. So currently, they are not.
That's correct.
Able to be recognized as these pass-through partnerships mm-hmm. for that industry. So my question is, why do we not wait for the IRS to come up with that code before trying to make our State Bank Act reflect this, that's somewhat in conflict with the IRS current regulations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, I think our reasoning for that is, first of all, there's been a movement. We've actually looked at presenting this bill in previous sessions, and it's gained enough momentum so that we wanted to go forward. We recognize that the Oregon legislature only meets every 2 years. We do expect change within the next few months, at least, in the IRS rules. And if we waited until that happened, of course, we'd be out of session. So that was our reason for wanting to move forward at this time.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Foley, if I could add as well, I think what Mr. Postlewaite said that was very important is the bank that he started and then was sold in 2001 went 5 years. The first, its whole existence, it never paid a dividend. So it was, in effect, not paying, those individuals were not paying any tax on that, on their investment. As a LLC, they will be paying from day one. So that is going to make a difference to Oregon's revenues. I don't know. I apologize if the administrator mentioned it, but I don't think that the revenue office is going to be able to give you a very good number, because nobody's going to know what percentage will be formed this way. Right now in Oregon, I would guess in the last few years, it's two or three new banks a year. It's not a lot, but that's kind of where we're at in the business cycle.
Representative Kidd.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there's a different way to look at this as dealing with the revenue ramifications. I think that this is a good jobs bill. This allows people to start banks easier, make them more profitable, thus paying more taxes, loaning more money to more small businesses, thus creating jobs, thus creating an income for hardworking Oregonians, thus paying an income tax. And we all know this state is 74.6% reliant upon an income tax. That's where the revenue shortfall in the state comes in, is when our people aren't working. What this allows, and I applaud you for your efforts of $100 million to people in the fishing industry, the people in the logging industry, people in the small business and the tourism industry, that it's difficult for those people to get loans in the first place. They're generally higher risk loans because of the nature of the industry and how it's regulated by this body in and of itself. So I applaud you for your efforts. If this is one more tool that this committee or this body can do to put Oregonians to work, and like my good representative from Happy Valley said and stated, I would much rather see dividends paid on profits for Oregon banks than Bank of America, U.S. Bank, or any other corporate bank. So I applaud you. I'll be voting yes on this.
Thank you, Representative. Janet, you had a comment on the revenue. From revenue.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the bill was given a no revenue impact from the Legislative Revenue Office. In my conversation with that office, they said the way the bank organizes doesn't necessarily mean their filing status. That was one thing they said. They did also mention the difference between the 6% and 9%, and as a corporation, they may not be paying any corporate income taxes currently. So those are the three things. But it was given a know, which pretty much it could be indeterminate as well, revenue impact. But Mr. Chair, if you need more information from that office, we can make sure people get it.
I think to follow up somewhat on Representative Kitt's remarks, you know, the larger national banks, you know, the Bank of America, and even now U.S. Bank is the stock ownership in those banks. Why? I'm sure there's a number of people in Oregon own stock in those banks, but the majority of them is going to be out of Oregon. So if there's any income tax paid on dividends that's derived out of profits in Oregon and passed through to the stockholders, it's not going to be paid in the state of Oregon. It's going to be paid in other states if they do have an income tax. By a locally chartered bank under the LLC provisions that would allow in this year, that 9% income tax would be paid, and be paid in the state of Oregon. It wouldn't be paid in some other state. It would be paid here. It would only be paid to the federal tax in the other state. Representative Schaffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been reading the paper lately. Does anybody in this state pay corporate income taxes?
Thank you. Any other comments? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got some concerns about this bill. I think I can eventually get to a point where I can vote for it. One question I have, is there anything in this bill that would prohibit somebody from, like Wells Fargo, from buying up the shares of the LLC bank and then just pocketing the tax advantages that might come along with that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shields, I need to think about that a little bit. But first of all, in an LLC, you don't have shares, you have membership interest. But I think your question is, could Wells Fargo or somebody like that come along and, in effect, turn this bank that we're talking about organizing as an LLC into a subsidiary? And I don't believe there is anything in the law that would prohibit that. I mean, it is possible for a corporation generally to have as a wholly owned subsidiary either another corporation or an LLC of which the parent would be the sole member.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Schaffler.
Then they would still be paying any profit. Income taxes on any profit made in that bank here in the state of Oregon, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Schaffler, that's exactly
right.
Correct. The way an LLC is taxed is it's a pass-through entity. So if it makes income, if it has more income than expenses, then all of that net income flows through to its member or members. So in the example that we were just talking about, all of that income would be taxed to the parent corporation. If we don't have that situation, if the three of us here are the members of the LLC, then we're going to be taxed on our individual returns on that same income.
And just for the record, as we learn with Enron, I think we will eventually see that, you know, what's taxed here in the state is going to stay in the state. I hope someday we get there. I don't care if it's a bank or a utility or who it is. If it's generated in the state, it stays in the state, doesn't go down to Houston, where they do whatever they want with it and never see it again. So hopefully we can do something along those lines, too.
And Representative Schaffler, I think that's one of the prime motivations for us for this bill, is that we think it will give us a much better opportunity to keep local business local.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, I think that's the point. Yes, they could do it, but there's no benefit. They'd end up paying more in taxes in Oregon if they were to go down that road.
Just one last question, I promise. So a corporation like Wells Fargo, if they buy into a bank in, say, any state, my understanding then of the law is that they would have to pay in each state that they own LLC shares, or...
Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be correct.
The
they would be responsible. Yeah. So I don't think it makes any sense for a Wells or Bank of America to start doing that, because... $100 million is a lot of loans in the coastal community. It's not necessarily a lot of loans to Wells Fargo.
Well, why would a corporation want to, a banking corporation particularly want to own shares in an LLC?
Right.
You know, they'd end up paying 9% when they don't have to pay 6% on their profit.
Mr. Chairman, that's the point I was trying to make with them, Shields. There's no benefit for them to do that. It's going to cost them.
You know, in this committee, we talk about other financial institutions. You know, we talk about savings and loans, and we talk about credit unions. And when you're talking about credit unions, you're talking about members. And here in the LLC, we're talking about members. So what's the difference?
Mr. Chair, our whole goal with something like this is to stop it. I think a Wells Fargo could buy our bank. They'd probably convert it back to a branch within their corporate structure, do away with the LLC. But the whole thing, the whole goal we have right there is kind of a preemptive thing where we create something where our members do not want to sell it. So that's my goal there, is to get to a point where we have the corporate structure that can react to these things a little. A lot of these banks, they please their shareholders by a larger per share price in a large market. With 140 shareholders, the practicality of that just isn't there. So the way that we have to satisfy our shareholders is through dividends. Now, that's kind of a new concept in banks, because banks haven't given much in the way of dividends. They've always told people to watch your share price. With 140 shareholders, that doesn't happen. And I might add, out of 140 shareholders, there's only one or two that are not Oregon residents. That's because they were friends of somebody who was already in there, and they called them in there. I believe of 140, there's 120 or so from Lincoln County, our part of the world. So they're all people there with a vested interest in this particular bank. We do have 25 employees for our little bank, and that's a lot of people. What happens when it's purchased by a Wells Fargo, and this is the recent experience, is that's reduced to about 5. So it does provide jobs locally for people. And that $100 million, that's providing construction funds for contractors to build houses. Just this, our fisherman director has been, he kind of takes younger fishermen under his wing, and two of them are out buying boats right now. They were part of an Alaska fishery that, you know, it's kind of going on without them, and they're out buying boats right now, and we're going to finance a piece of that. So we're the vehicle where these younger fishermen get into a rather expensive, capital-intensive business. We've had good luck doing this. It's a job that I absolutely love. And it's really frustrating when it gets to a point where somebody comes in and makes an offer that you have to do what you think is best for your shareholders and not what's best for the community. With the passing of this bill, I think that will change. I think it'll allow us to go to the shareholders and say, you've got a lot. This isn't going to benefit you as much as you can any future sale. And if you'll just stay the course here, we'll provide benefits to you that will be very pleasing to you in the long run.
The question I posed was that we have, in a LLC, you have members. In a credit union, you have members. What's the basic difference of the organizations?
Mr. Chairman, there isn't a great deal of difference. The credit union is organized as a cooperative under the Oregon Cooperative Law or the federal statute. And, of course, we're talking about an LLC. But it is true that both have members, and they're both essentially pass-through organizations in terms of the taxes coming through to the individual owners or members of the entities. Does that respond to your question?
To the basic, what's the real main basic difference, though? We've had a considerable discussion here about income tax and concern about the revenue flowing out there.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding that the profits from the credit union stay within the organization and they're not passed through to the members. They gain a greater share, but not taxable. Is that right?
Well, I'm not an expert, Mr. Chairman, on credit union taxation by any means. I don't work in that area, but my understanding is that the only tax that accrues with regard to credit union is the tax on the member, to the extent that that is passed, that the profits are passed through to the,
okay.
And in that sense, they're similar.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone here else that would like to testify on House Bill 3324? Is there anyone, no one from the department here to DCBS? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3324 and open a work session on House Bill 3324. Representative Ketz.
Mr. Chairman, I would move enthusiastically House Bill 3324, this good jobs bill, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ketz moves House Bill 3324 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Ketz.
Mr. Chairman, I think in times of rhetoric in our state, when our state is needing of money, needing of revenue, we talk about programs that need to be funded, at what levels they need to be funded, and it's always a question of dollars. And I applaud the financial industry for coming forward with something that appears to be a bill that would do just that, help create more jobs, not just within the financial industry, but outside of the financial industry, in those entities and industries in which they finance. And I think this is very much a jobs bill for Oregon, and I think it's a good vote.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it could be. I think I need to get a little more information about this, particularly on the revenue impact, and also to make myself feel more comfortable that this will be good for small banks. I think I'd like to get a little more time. So I think at this point I'll probably be voting no.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I have one question. I think Representative Shields brings up a good point, and maybe the chair could, or Janet could answer for me. He speaks to the revenue, and I think that's a very, very valid concern, and it's a concern of mine, too, on the flip side. It says there is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact. I'm curious what more revenue could do if there's anything beyond this that they could do or look further. I would be interested to know that. Do you know, Janet?
In terms of a positive.
I'm just trying. If we peel back the onion further, is there more research that revenue could do for us on this bill? Because if there's more research that they could provide, I'd like to hear it. But otherwise, I don't know. I just want to make sure that I'm covering all my bases as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I didn't go further with them to ask that, but they may be able to do that for you.
Okay. Thank you.
And as Janet stated, they said there was indeterminate the amount of impact that revenue impact it could possibly have, and I don't know how they could really pin it down exactly. I don't believe it'll have a negative impact. I think it has a positive impact when you consider the different structures between the C corp and an LLC or a sub S, and the ownership of these banks would be local, and so it would. It's a simple matter of math. You got 9% or 6% at the corporation level, and then if the majority of the ownership and large national banks are out of this state, then we have no, and we don't get another bite of the apple.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Yes.
I'm going to, just for the committee's knowledge, I'm going to go to revenue immediately following this, and I'm going to ask what the revenue impact would be on your county or specific counties had $100 million not been invested in the kind of jobs that creates. So I think that's the kind of revenue question we need to ask.
Well, and in addition, I don't know how many S-Corps or LLCs are formed or in this, around the state in other industries, and so I fail to see how the revenue impact applied to one industry and not to the rest of the corporations within the state of Oregon is a fair assessment of the overall situation. And with that, committee, before we do a vote, I want to declare a possible conflict of interest because I do own shares in local-owned banks in the state of Oregon. And any other discussion?
You okay.
Katie, please call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Aye.
Representative
Shields. No.
Representative Bassett.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
No.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. And I'll be glad to carry the bill on the House floor. Let's see, where are we at now? We're down to 2616. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2615. And also at this time make an announcement that House Bill 2740 we're going to carry over. We won't carry that today. Janet, please give us a rundown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2615 specifies that Oregon Health and Science University full-time teaching faculty will accrue a year of retirement service credit under the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan for each regular teaching year. School employees that are under PERS and under OPSERP, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan established for new employees last session, if they're school employees at Oregon University System or at public schools, they accrue a year of retirement service credit for a regular teaching year, which is usually about 9.5 months. But Oregon University System faculty were included in the definition of school employee in the 2000 legislation, but in what may have been an oversight, OHSU teaching staff and faculty were not. House Bill 2015 would include OHSU teaching faculty in the definition of school employees, so that those faculty members that were hired after August 29, 2003, and who participate in the OPSERP will accrue a year of service credit for their normal teaching year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Let's see. Gordon, the only one we have signed up here is Gordon Allen. Good morning, Mr. Allen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gordon Allen. I am the retirement program manager for the human resources at Oregon Health and Science University. Appreciate the opportunity to share comments on House Bill 2615. This is a housekeeping measure pertaining to the classification of school employees at OHSU. OHSU does support House Bill 2615. In 1995, under Senate Bill 2, now ORS Chapter 353, OHSU transitioned from a state employee to a public corporation. As a public corporation, OHSU was no longer considered a university within the Oregon University System. House Bill 2020 of the 2003 legislative session established the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, now ORS 238A. When a school employee was defined under House Bill 2020, OHSU employees engaged in teaching or other school activities were not included in the definition under Section 11.6. ORS 238A established a new pension plan for employees hired on or after August 29, 2003. The definition carried forward from House Bill 2020 to ORS 238.140 does not include OHSU employees as school employees. OHSU has approximately 60 school employees. Some of these employees do work outside of the metropolitan area. For example, some may be in LaGrange or Ashland, but a very few number of total employees at OHSU. The purpose of this amendment is to include OHSU school employees and to treat them in the same manner that school employees in the Oregon University System are treated. It provides credible service to school employees since the school year is less than the equivalent of 2,000 hours per year. This amendment would also provide accrual of pension benefits consistent with other school employees under the new pension plan. OHSU submits, supports the amendment to include employees of OHSU engaged in teaching or school activity at an institution of higher education as a school employee. We would like to work with the chair and recommend also that we look at and possibly revise the effective date of House Bill 2615 to reflect on or after August 29, 2003. This was the effective date of House Bill 2020, and by providing 2003 as the effective date, it treats similarly situated employees equitably. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to share comments on House Bill 2615. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Gordon, the OHSU, the teachers, they have the option of being in a 401 type retirement program also in addition, or in replace of PERS.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Employees at Oregon Health and Science University may choose PERS or a alternative retirement plan.
Okay. Is there any other representative Kitts?
Mr. Chair, currently it states there's no revenue impact or no fiscal impact, but the way the bill is written, it takes effect immediately. If you were to, in fact, go back and make it retroactive to 2003, would there not then be a revenue or fiscal impact upon that bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, we see that there really is no fiscal impact. It's a very small number of employees.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow up. I understand that you may not think that, but when 2615 was drafted and when the statement was issued, it was issued according to the way the bill is drafted, correct? And not an amended version that would take it back 2 years.
Yeah.
So it should probably be vetted at least one more time. If it's amended,
yeah. Right. I agree.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitt, one of the reasons for looking at the August 29, 2003 is that we have passed through 2004, so some of those new employees would be impacted by the accrual of benefits for the year 2004. Very few.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Gordon, for your testimony. Steve, did you have anything to add to it? Steve is shaking his head. No. All right. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2615 and open the hearing on House Bill 2372. And could I have John Brenneman and Sean Miller, please? Janet, can you give us a rundown on what the bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2372, at the request of the Recreational Vehicle Coalition, specifies that the requirement for a recreational vehicle manufacturer or distributor, who's referred to as the grantor in the bill, it specifies that the requirement that they buy back inventory from a dealer upon termination of a dealership agreement applies to terminations that are instigated by the grantor. And the Dash 1 amendments, which are at your place today, apply the repurchase agreement or requirement, apply the repurchase requirement to new RVs that the dealer bought from the grantor within a year of the termination, regardless of the model year of the vehicle. Mr. Chair, the amendments have been hand engrossed into the bill, and that should have been at your place too to show how the bill would read. They delete section sub B and simplify the requirement for the repurchase. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's no revenue or fiscal impact on this bill.
Thank you, Janet. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association. RVIA is a national trade association of RV manufacturers. If you have a recent RV, probably see one of our stickers on the side of the RV. We're based in Reston, Virginia, and as I think most of you know, we have a large number of manufacturers of RVs in the state. To give you a little bit of background, I've been with RVIA now for about four or five sessions, but about 6 years ago, the automobile dealers had a bill to establish a dealer's rights piece of legislation. I went to, at the request of RVIA, I went to the dealers and asked if RVs could be exempted from that dealer's rights, with provision that we would sit down with dealers the next session and construct an RV dealer's rights bill. And they said yes. It didn't happen 4 years ago, but it happened 2 years ago, and we passed House Bill 2670 last session, which had about 10 or 11 issues, protective issues for dealers. And we patterned it after a national model that's on the table, but we spent, Sean Miller, who represents dealers, he and I are the coalition represented here today, and we spent a number of meetings working that bill through. What happened as a result of that bill is that what we turned into LC had the word grantor that you see in today's bill 2372 on line 6 on the first page. Somewhere along the line, by the grantor didn't get put in the bill, and none of us caught it until a few months ago, and we went to the dealers and asked if we could correct what we think was an error, a Scrivener's error of some type that occurred in last year's bill 2670, and to restore that. After we met, they did agree that there was an error in the bill, that it should say that. They did ask because they had some dealers who liked it written the way it was, if we would do something to for them in the course of sitting down negotiating this bill, if they would do something back for them that they could take back to their dealers and say, well, we got a little bit extra. And that's what's contained in the Dash 1 amendment that we both support. And so if the grantor now makes that dissolution of the franchise, we've extended that buyback period of those that were purchased by the dealer for the prior year would take them back. And I think Sean, when he gives his testimony, will agree that we're sitting up here hugging each other, endorsing the Dash 1 amendment, and the bill is amended, and urge your support.
Thank you. Sean?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Dealers, Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association, and I don't normally hug John Brenneman, but in this case, the dealers that I represent, and it is an important industry both for the manufacturers and the dealers in the state of Oregon, we've had a very good relationship over the years, and we did negotiate in good faith a franchise legislation last session. It was passed. We're probably considered a national model. Other states are looking to our bill. We pretty much lead the industry, the state of Oregon, when it comes to recreational vehicles. And we do recognize that even though the current law as drafted is a benefit directly to dealers and left out the grantor provision, we did recognize that's not what we agreed to last session. So the integrity of my group obviously was to support the manufacturers in changing that back to what the original intent was. In the meantime, there is some statute in the Dash or language in the Dash 1 amendment that talks about provisions of the buyback if they were to cancel. And you can see in lines 8 where it talks about current model year, and in lines 10 the prior model year, where you had 120 days worth of if you bought a prior model year. Current practice, sometimes you can have three model years in for instance, this year, 2005. For instance, you would have bought something of 2004 and have it in inventory. You would have it, obviously, this year, 2005, and many manufacturers will issue 2006 models in 2005, and they don't wait till January 1 to issue a 2006. Normally, you have three different model years, and the way the current statute reads, there is some confusion on current model year, what they would actually be required to buy back. We just eliminate that, and the manufacturers agree to simplify it to just say any model year within the last 12 months that you bought would be bought back by the manufacturer. And it's a lot easier way to read the statute, and we would support the bill and its original intent of what we agreed to last session with the Dash 1 amendments, which I think simplifies the current practice of the models that's on the RV lots. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Chaffler.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, and maybe I asked this question 2 years ago, what does the manufacturer do with all that stuff they buy back? Just store it and sell it out as they need it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, my guess is it goes back on the shelf and resold as parts, and if some gets obsolete, I suppose like any business person, at some point you dispose of it. But
thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see none. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2372, and let's see, this doesn't go anywhere to the floor, huh?
Right.
And open a work session on House Bill 2372.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment?
Janet wants to make a comment.
It's pretty amazing that the length of that bill from last session, that this is the only change that's being made, because that was a complicated... I guess it speaks to these two guys working together pretty well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
And it speaks to the brilliant leadership that Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee supplied the state with last session. Isn't that correct, Representative?
Why did you throw in the last session? But you were doing fine.
I think it goes to show, Mr. Chairman, what can be accomplished in this building with a mere hug.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill.
Need the Dash 1.
Sorry, I would move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2372.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1s to 2372. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? They're adopted. Representative Kitt.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill.
As amended. Thank you.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2372 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative Fox.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Vestibon.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye. Motion carried. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, with the simplicity of the bill, I would move it be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves that House Bill 2372 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is on the consent calendar. Janet, do you have anything else for us this morning? Okay, so we got a committee bill, huh? I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill, LC 3484.
So moved.
And Mr. Chair, the motion, we're after the deadline for bill introductions. The motion on this needs to be, we are requesting the speaker the speaker
approved
introduction. Thank you.
Speaker approved introduction.
Yes.
To the committee.
Do you know
that the committee's recommending the speaker approve the recommendation from the committee?
Okay, this is just a draft. We're just putting it into committee, correct?
Yeah.
Right. They all are.
Since
past the deadline.
Okay.
And we did get the speakers.
Okay, somebody make that motion, please.
I'll make the motion.
Representative Escobar moves that LC 3484 be introduced as a committee bill with the speaker's approval. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's introduced as a committee bill.
Thanks.
Is there anything else?
Mr. Chair, 8 o'clock on Wednesday and no meeting on Friday.
Woo-hoo. Good. With that, we are adjourned.